Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. The End of Men? Maybe not exactly, but that's the title of Hannah Rosen's provocative new book, destined to spark a whole lot of conversation around this country. Hannah Rosen's point, since the dawn of humankind, men have been the dominant sex, but maybe no longer. Women have taken over college classrooms and previously male professions such as pharmacology. Women are not just catching up anymore, she writes. They are becoming the standard by which success is measured. That's a mouthful, and so is her book titled The End of Men and the Rise of Women. Hannah Rosen is senior editor at The Atlantic and a founder of Double X, the women's section at Slate. She joins us this morning from the studios of KQED in San Francisco. And Hannah Rosen, welcome. So good to have you today.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, the genesis of this book came in 2009 when you accidentally knocked your grocery cart into another woman's and spilled some of her granola bars. What happened there, and how did that manage to kickstart this book?
Yes, that's a story I tell in the introduction. As a journalist, right. I'd been thinking about what was happening to men during the recession, and I had been reading Susan Faludi's book, Stiffed, about the changing notions of manhood after the last recessions. And so I bumped into this woman's grocery cart, and we started talking. I asked her if she was married. Did she have a kid? And she said, you know, yes, she had a kid. Where was the husband? And she basically described her husband as, and I know your male listeners are going to cringe here, but I'm just reporting, as something like another mouth to feed. Which is a phrase I heard a lot from women around the country. And I'm sorry, I apologize beforehand. It's just something I heard a lot from women. And I got in touch with this guy whose name was Calvin.
It's Calvin,
and
right.
I tried to Calvin, and I tried to put them back together. I became kind of a, you know, like, can this marriage be saved? Like his life coach. You know, that happens sometimes as a journalist, as you get slightly over-involved in people's lives. And at some point, this was when my light bulb went off, I realized that there was no old life for Calvin to go back to. It wasn't like I could re-engineer a situation where he would just take his seat at the table and they would be the happy family again, because these other dynamics had already taken root, namely that this woman was supporting her family. She was the head of her household, for better or worse. I'm not saying this is a perfect setup. I'm just saying this is what happened, and that she wasn't going to give up the seat that easily. She was going to school, raising the kid. You know, she had a certain sense that he was not living up to her expectations of what a perfect husband should look like. And so my job was basically impossible. And that's when I had the revelation that things had changed or were starting to change in a way that was permanently affecting so much about how we live, decisions we make about marriage and relationships and all kinds of things.
You say Calvin was pretty open to talking about you. What else did he say to you that sort of helped fuel this book?
Well, Calvin was, you know, this is a criticism I've gotten of the book. Why are the guys in your book such couch potatoes, you know? And I think, well, look, I was looking at a certain segment of society. Like, I was trying to find a place where the women effectively reminded me of immigrants. And there are several women in the book like this. You know, they're sort of working class women. They're really striving ahead. Sometimes they don't want to. They're not necessarily feminists. They're sort of either supporting their families or they see an opportunity and they grab it. Whereas the men in their lives are sort of like the people we left behind in the old country. You know, they're a little less flexible. They've been left behind by the manufacturing economy or the construction boom. And so they're having a harder time adapting to what the economy is throwing their way.
I was going to say, how is the recession affecting these guys? And when you say they can't go back to their old lives, you're talking about what exactly there?
Well, there's another chapter I have which takes place in a town in Alabama where I try and do a broader view of what happens to a town when the central manufacturing plant leaves the town. And what you see is the men who had been used to working in a certain way for so long had basically expected that they would have a lifelong job and a fairly prosperous middle-class existence by working at this place and rising through its ranks. That option was really no longer available to them, and yet they seemed like they didn't really know how to move on from there. There weren't that many options that seemed appealing to them, that played up to their natural strengths. And so they weren't sure what to do. This kind of living had been so central to their masculine identity that it was hard to know how to move on. Whereas the women were kind of starting from scratch, you know, often starting from the bottom, often underpaid, and then rising their way up. It was a little easier for them, even if it wasn't what they wanted.
They seem more flexible to you in many ways compared to the men.
Yes, another thing that people sometimes find insulting. But I was trying to think of a catch-all term to describe the differences between men and women
and
that
you
I was noticing.
And you did it,
noticing.
By the way. Yeah.
Yes, and
tell
I did
us
it.
About
so,
that. Yeah.
So I'll tell you about that term. So it's not intelligence, because women and men measure equally smart on all sorts of, you know, standard measures. So it's not really that we could pinpoint. I think just at this moment in history, it's something like flexibility. So if you look across the century, you see that women have so vastly changed the way they are in the public sphere. You know, they used to not work at all, and then they had to stop working when they got married, and all that has gone away over the century. And, you know, they move into professions that are predominantly male professions. Pharmacy is one that I described, because that used to be a guy's profession, is now largely dominated by women. Whereas men don't do the opposite. They don't tend to go into professions that they think of as women's professions. In fact, they find them toxic and slightly embarrassing. So that's what I mean by the quality of flexibility. And by the way, men have been flexible at other points in history. I think of like World War II and the GI Bill, when men sort of flooded into colleges and took over farms and were very flexible. So it's just an accident of this moment in history.
And so you came up with these two representative characters for the book, Plastic Woman and Cardboard Man.
Yes, that's the cartoon super heroines and heroes that kept appearing to me as I was going chapter through chapter. Plastic Woman sort of being moldable in all her habits, you know, basically sort of molding to whatever is thrown her way, for better and worse. You know, flexibility can really drive you crazy, because a lot of the women in the book, you feel like they're doing too much, you know, they're bending too much, taking on too much. Whereas Cardboard Man was a little slower, a little more rigid, a little slower to respond to what was happening.
And so
I'm sorry if you're not a rigid guy. Maybe you're a flexible guy yourself.
Well, we try.
We
try very hard, yeah. Well, you end up saying your grand pronouncement in this book, Hannah, is this notion that women, for the first time in history, have in many ways, you write, surpassed men. In fact, you say, we have reached the end of 200,000 years of human history and have launched this new era. Are you convinced of this, or is it just a theory at this point?
That's quite a grand claim that I'm making. Wow, when you read it back to me, it really does sound quite big. So what you see is women setting down roots and for success. I mean, it's hard not to project that when you see that, you know, for 20 some years, the engine of advancement in our society, which is getting a college degree, again, for better and worse, women are just much better at doing that. And if you look at the jobs projected to grow over the next decades, they are largely female dominated, with the exception of the computer industry. So many jobs that people think are going to expand are female dominated. And then you also see, I mean, I have a section where I address the top and power and richness and sort of what's blocking women there and the next steps we have to go through. So I suppose that last step is a projection, but it's really a very small part of society. I mean, this has only been going on for 40 years, and we've had such tremendous change in the power dynamics that there's no reason to believe it wouldn't continue.
You know, I was going to say, you do wonder in a sense, because women's reproductive choices are still under attack. You know, what's to keep this dominance from one day dipping again?
So the reproductive choices is an interesting thing to bring up because of our political season.
Yeah.
And that struck me as such a backlash. I mean, the idea that we were talking about contraception felt to me like a reaction against the forces that I was describing, because so many American families, most American families, are dependent on a woman's income right now, much more so than they were 30 years ago. And a growing number of American families are headed by a breadwinner, a wife who runs the family. And so financially speaking. And so the idea that we could somehow reopen the debate on contraception is slightly absurd, just given the economic realities. I mean, will those economic realities change? I guess it's possible, sure, because technology makes certain professions obsolete that we didn't expect, you know, all the time. And so you never can predict quite perfectly.
And you're talking to a political reporter here who's covering a state where one U.S. Senate candidate is talking about things like legitimate rape.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You guys are in the legitimate rape
yes,
state.
We
That's
are.
Right. That was a gem of this election, that particular term. Exactly. But even the descriptions of the single, you know, the daughter who was pregnant and didn't have a husband, I mean, that's so much more common these days. It's one of the things I describe in the book is that how the rise of women is changing marriage patterns, both for the college-educated and the non-college-educated. So that to treat that as some kind of unusual, shameful scenario is crazy, especially if you're reaching out to voters. It's increasingly common. In fact, I think we've passed the mark recently. The New York Times did a front-page story where more than half of children born to women under 30 were born to single mothers. So it's hardly an unusual situation these days.
And we'll talk about marriage patterns in just a few minutes. Again, we're visiting with Hannah Rosen. She's the author of The End of Men and the Rise of Women. And we're wondering, do you buy this notion that we're entering a new era where women reign supreme? Are you noticing big changes out there when it comes to gender roles? What do you make of Hannah Rosen's premise? Our phone number here, 816-235-2888. Our email address is up to date at kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page or tweet us at KCUR up to date. I'm just wondering, Hannah, how is your book being received? What kinds of reactions are you getting? Because I'm just guessing here you're getting a whole bunch.
All over the map.
I bet.
I will take the women first. So I've heard from a lot of young women, and we haven't gotten to this topic yet, but who are happy at my description of their dating lives, of what the hookup culture in college is like. They're happy to have it described as having an element of empowerment, and we can talk about that later.
Yeah.
And then I've heard from some feminists who say, you know, essentially what you said, look, the men are still in power. We've still got a workforce that doesn't have paid maternity leave mandated. There are so many problems for women in this workforce. And actually, I agree with that. That's a criticism I agree with. And I we can talk about that more, too. And then from men, you know, the title alone is likely to send men's temperature through the roof and have them booing, you know, without me even opening my mouth. So there's definitely that element of response. And then there's another set of men who think, you know, the stay-at-home dads, for example, or men who are perfectly happy that their wives make more money than they do, who are happy to have the gender roles and the burdens on them relaxed a little bit and become more socially acceptable. So that's the range.
I was going to say, how is all this affecting the way men and women think about marriage, love, and sex for that matter? Because as you write in this book, it's having profound consequences.
So we can start with marriage, I suppose.
Yeah.
There is two very different marriage patterns taking hold in America, like everything else, every other way in which we're a class-divided society. This is true for marriage as well. And so what you see among the college-educated marriage is a new pattern of marriage that I call the seesaw marriage, which is that anybody can play any role at any given time. So the Obamas have a classic seesaw marriage, just to take a couple everyone's familiar with, where, you know, in the beginning of their marriage, she's making a lot of money as a healthcare executive. He's going to law school. He's taking lower paying jobs in the, you know, in the public realm, and she's still an executive. And then now she's the first lady and he's the president. So you can switch back and forth. It doesn't matter so much. Theoretically, you can switch back and forth. And that has produced the stablest, happiest, in other words, people defining themselves as happy or very happy marriages with the lowest divorce rates that we've had in a long time. For the non-college educated, you see not just a different, but an opposite pattern taking hold.
Yeah.
Far fewer marriages happening in the first place. And as I discussed earlier, a lot more women having children on their own, not because they don't want to be married, as you see from the women I write about in the book and the woman we mentioned in the introduction of the book, Bethany, but because they have high ideals for marriage and the men around them don't quite match up to those ideals. So those are very different patterns.
That's interesting. Let's go to some phone calls here. 816-235-2888. Again, our guest, Hannah Rosen, author of The End of Men and the Rise of Women. Let's go to Denise from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, Denise. Go ahead.
Well, you know what? I am a working woman, and I'm kind of the breadwinner in my home, which I'm really thrilled about. But I wanted to say, and if you have comments to make about this, is when I was in college in the 80s, I was in school with women who were in their 40s, who traditionally got married out of high school, had babies, and then when the marriage didn't work out for, you know, midlife crisis or what, these women were out. They were kicked out of the street, and they, you know, they didn't get big alimony checks. They had to get an education, and they had to provide for their kids and themselves. And so right then and there, I thought I was 20 years old, and I thought, well, a man is not a financial plan. And so I just kind of took it upon myself to say, you know what, I've got to be able to take care of myself. And I'm wondering if you're guest would have any comment on that.
How about
and
that,
I think
Hannah?
I think there's a stigma. There's a stigma when women are single, make more money than their partners, and, you know, that's kind of, you know, I'm supposed to find somebody who makes $1 zillion.
Hannah?
Instead of really care about the quality of the person I'm with.
Go ahead, Hannah.
I think that both of the trends that the caller describes are true. In other words, the idea that there was a point at which women decided and are still deciding a man is not a financial plan. I like that phrase. I haven't used it myself, but it's probably one that ran through the heads of women of a certain generation, either the post-divorce generation. And also a younger generation of women now in the town in Alabama where I reported who have seen their fathers lose their jobs, basically, and so have had a sense that, you know, maybe they better also have a profession and support themselves, even if that was not necessarily the vision of marriage that they'd had before this period. So a lot of women wanting and thinking about being economically independent for better and worse, that's really quite common these days. And in terms of her comment about love, it's really been an education for me getting letters from young women who say to me, look, it's not like, you know, we're out there looking for a bunch of one-night stands, mm-hmm. but we're not quite looking to get married either yet. So what we are doing is creating these new forms of temporary emotional intimacy, you know, just having these relationships which are short term, which are great, but which don't necessarily tie us down. So I don't think it's the opposite of love. I don't think it's also crass and, you know, I'm just establishing my career. I make more money than you do. I mean, I think love endures anyway, teenage love, like romance. I mean, those are things we can't quite kill with economic realities.
But that's women sort of taking on the view that men have more traditionally had about love and sex, though, isn't it? I mean, you're seeing sort of a blurring there as opposed to two distinct styles.
Yeah, I mean, it's not taking on because I think there are differences. You know, you almost never run into women. You do run into some, and you do in the movies. The movie The Bachelorette has the most that came out this month, the most trash-talking, foul-mouthed. You know, it's interesting that pop culture is bringing up these sorts of women. But and I have some of them in my book as well. But I think on the whole, what you find is women enter that culture, let's say in their early years of college, and then they get sick of it basically a year out. And they start to complain, you know, why won't men ever commit? And then they come to this third place, which is, you know, I'm in this kind of bind. Mm-hmm. I don't like this full-on hookup culture, but I don't want to be tied down yet. I really am not ready to be married. And so let me come up with something new, which I suppose, as you're saying, kind of meets what we think of as the traditionally male view halfway, but not all the way.
Yeah. Again, our guest, Hannah Rosen, she says women are not just catching up anymore. They are becoming the standard by which success is measured. 816-235-2888 is our phone number, our email address, updatedate@kcur.org. Let's go to Marilyn from Prairie Village. Marilyn, good morning.
Good morning. Yes, I would like to make a comment that I think this situation or phenomenon has been going on for many years.
Mm.
And for those of us that got good educations, college educations, and were the breadwinners for their families, even if their partner could have been, and after maybe many years of being the provider and at home and at work, finally decided they'd met their commitments and moved on, or finding that they're being very hurt financially in the divorce process.
That's interesting.
So this is giving the younger women the idea, why would I want to get married?
Well, I guess that raises the question, Hannah, how new is this phenomenon, at least in your view? And Marilyn, thank you for the good call.
Thank you.
It's been taking root for some number of years. I mean, this didn't happen overnight that women started going to college. I think they reached parity with men in the 80s and then started to surpass men in the, you know, 20, 30 years since. And as we know, the manufacturing era has been slowly dying and moving overseas for some period of time. And then we had the housing crisis. So we've just had through the 90s and 2000s a series of recessions that have allowed this this dynamic, which was there under the surface, to really reveal itself only because of we've had such hard economic times.
Yeah. Let me go to Dan from Kansas City, Missouri. Dan, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, I kind of want to run through some things like how the women don't really seem to admit to their poor choice in men, and then they want to play the martyrs when they have kids and all. And, you know, the whole culture seems to be pointed towards their spending habits, all about their vanity. Most of the commercials, the men are always dorks, and the husbands, they can't handle anything. You know, it gets old. They get to play the martyr, you know, and then, but they don't really own up to anything.
Dan, thanks. Respond to that, Hannah.
I often think about, you know, can economic realities really determine how you feel about something? It's like a weird line, you know, can these things really shade each other? And so what he's saying is, you know, I suppose one sees, for example, lots of what they call serial cohabitation, sort of women, you know, people living with people over and over again. And so can you describe that as poor choices or as rational choices, you know, not wanting to stay with someone who is not really a provider or supporter, or are you making poor choices? I don't know. You know, I think it depends on each case.
I mean, do you think this change we're seeing sort of reflects what you would regard as a natural order of things, Hannah, or what about that?
You know, I try and resist that phase.
Yeah,
I think that my
right.
argument would be much easier if I believe that. Like, if I believe that women were set up in a certain way, that their brain structures made them more, you know, empathetic or this way or that way, and men's were this way or that way, it would be easier for me to explain what's happening between men and women. But I think largely these things vary over culture and time. And I brought up the example of World War II and men's flexibility. So I'm sure that eventually neuroscientists are going to pinpoint important differences between the male and female brain, but will those differences ever be so determining that they, you know, that they determine what choices we make about whether to go to school or how we get married? I mean, these are complicated human choices. So I don't like to say women are, you know, by nature more suited to this or that, or men are by. It's always a combination of nature and circumstance, I think.
You know, Rudolph writes this at UpToDate at KCUR.org. The end of men is a harbinger of the end of society in general. Women have only gained in the last 35 years, not because men have declined, but because there has been a systematic attack on professions, manufacturing, construction, etc., that men have dominated in. In the societies that the manufacturing jobs have moved to, I bet they're not talking about the end of men there. What do you make of that?
I think he's absolutely right. I mean, I think a lot, as we've said, a lot of this is economic structure. And I also don't think a lot of this is great. I mean, as I say, it's not a triumphalist cheerleading kind of book. There are many parts of it that are probably quite depressing, where you see couples mm-hmm. at odds or in uncomfortable situations that they don't necessarily want to be in. So one hopes that it ends up in a more hopeful place where even the men who have been abandoned by the manufacturing economy, you know, we are thinking very hard, both presidential candidates, in fact, about what to do about that. What kinds of manufacturing can you bring back to America? The green economy, or high-tech manufacturing, or artisan manufacturing. You know, people are thinking of all sorts of terms that will allow men to continue to do the work that they like to do and maybe get a little more training. So sort of meet the economy halfway by getting educated for slightly new skills.
The question on the table, are we entering a new era where women reign supreme? Our phone number here again, 816-235-2888. Our email address, UpToDate at KCUR.org. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about Hannah Rosen and some of the research she did here in Kansas City, including an incident at Metropolitan Community College. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We are back. If you missed yesterday's conversation with Jeffrey Toobin about the Obama White House and the Supreme Court and our look at the future of Bishop Finn, you'll find them in all of our previous broadcasts at KCUR.org. Tomorrow, a special broadcast beginning at 10:45 in the morning as we bring you a live debate between the candidates for U.S. Senate in Missouri, Democratic incumbent Claire McCaskill, Republican Todd Akin, and Libertarian Jonathan Dime. Our live coverage begins at 10:45 in the morning from Columbia here on KCUR. This hour, we're visiting with Hannah Rosen about her provocative new book, The End of Men and the Rise of Women, in which she points out that women are not just catching up anymore, they've actually become the standard by which success is measured. You can join our conversation by calling 816-235-2888. Our email address is up to date at KCUR.org, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Lisa from Kansas City, Missouri, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
This is a really interesting topic.
I think it is too, Lisa.
So I'm in my mid-30s, and within my social group, almost all of the women have a higher level of formal education than the men that they're with, married or not. And I think that, like, the change in the men's job structure and maybe what they're doing for education has just made us all a little more, like, equal. But it's really impacted our decisions on family planning because the options for having, you know, time off and maternity leave or paternity leave haven't caught up with that. So while I definitely feel like I've been able to rise professionally and become a great standard in that way, it hasn't caught up for men to be able to rise family-wise and become a standard in that way financially.
Hannah?
I agree with that.
Go ahead, Hannah.
I agree with that on both fronts. One is that part of the reason I wrote this book is because if you don't point out what a strong force women are in the economy, that seems to me the first step to getting even the most basic changes, because then women will always face what they face now, which is a workforce that doesn't have mandatory maternity leave. I mean, we have a workforce that pretends it's 1962 and someone's always at home with the children, which is so massively not the case for most American families. We're really behind on that, so I completely agree. And then in terms of what she said with the men, I think there's a lot of confusion, especially in those early dating days on men's parts, about what the expectation is. I mean, they understand that they're not supposed to be a father the way their fathers were, that we expect fathers to be more involved. But they don't necessarily feel comfortable entirely saying, you know, oh, I'll take charge, honey. I'll be in charge of the kids. Like, that doesn't feel quite socially acceptable yet. It's not as if we've switched roles or we might ever switch roles. And so I spoke in my book to a lot of young men who basically felt to me like they were stuck in this permanent ambivalence. You know, they just didn't know which way to go, you know?
And you think that ambivalence will fade away within a few years?
Well, that's what I'm hoping. I mean, it's not that I think that when my two sons, I have a daughter and two sons, and when my two sons grow up, they will live in a world with, you know, 50% stay-at-home dads. No way. But do I hope that they live in a world in which it's perfectly okay if they are dating or engaged to or married to someone who makes more money than they do? And if the couple together makes some decisions like, look, she's really in a moment in her career when it would be great if she could sort of go full force for two or three years. And then he can, you know, step back a little bit so that those decisions are made pretty cleanly. That seems okay to me. That seems like that would be a recipe for a happy marriage.
Yeah. Lisa, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Well, I was struck that you did a lot of your research. You did some of it, at least, here in Kansas City. And at one point, you saw something here that has stuck with you ever since, as you write in the book. And it happened while you were visiting the Metropolitan Community College. Tell us what you witnessed in an elevator here.
Sure. I was in the community college and I saw a woman who fell asleep between the first and her eighth floor of the community college, or maybe it was the sixth floor. But it stuck with me for a long time because basically it was just a sense of exhaustion you got from the women there who were working, taking care of kids. I mean, there was a lot of women I'd run into in the cafeteria who were texting with their babysitters or sort of doing crazy childcare arrangements and also going to school at the same time. And that was for my original Atlantic story on which this book is based. I did a bunch of my reporting in colleges and in locations around Kansas City.
One other college you visited was here at UMKC, and you called it an example of a school where the student body is now tipping towards 60% women, a level that many admissions officers worry can permanently shift the atmosphere and reputation of a school. You refer to the 60% mark as the dreaded threshold. What do you mean by that exactly?
A lot of state schools, unlike, say, private universities, they, you know, take people in based on grades and SAT scores. And so you have a pretty clean admissions process. This isn't just in Kansas City, but all over the country. So you find that these big state schools are becoming predominantly female, somewhere in the order of 60%, 58%, 57%. And admissions officers don't like that. They like, for both social and academic reasons, for colleges and for sports reasons, frankly, for colleges to be, equally balanced. And so I think this is something that admissions officers really worry about. Now, if you're at a private university, you can correct it by essentially instituting the dirty word affirmative action for men. I mean, you can let in whoever you want and equalize your classes, but you can't do that at a state school. So that's when people started to worry about the gender disparity in colleges, is when it started to show up so drastically in big, good state schools.
You know, UMKC also has a pharmacy school, of course, and that's an area, as you already mentioned, an area of study and employment that you spend a whole chapter on. Tell us a little more about why becoming a pharmacist has begun to exemplify what women are striving to reach these days, Hannah.
Yes, pharmacy used to be a very male profession.
Yeah.
You were the leader in your town, and you would start your own pharmacy, and you were a businessman, and you worked all night long, and that used to be the structure of pharmacy. But as the world became globalized and larger companies took over, pharmacy became more like an office job. I mean, you essentially clock in and clock out, and it started to add lots of credentialing. So you used to need 2 years of school. Now you need something like 6 years of school. And so when all these changes happened, women flooded the profession, both because they weren't intimidated by the new educational requirements, and also because making pharmacy a clock in and out job made it more manageable for women. So they could work different hours depending on what phase of their life they were in. So they could work full time when they're younger, a little bit less time when they have kids, and then more later. And so women could make those decisions and not, say, have to be there all night because they were the one pharmacist in the local town.
Let's go to Ava from Kansas City, Missouri. Ava, you're on with Hannah Rosen, author of The End of Men and the Rise of Women. Good morning. You there, Ava? Let's go to Jack from Kansas City, Missouri. Jack, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
So there's no question in my mind that what Ava Rosen is dealing with here is a real phenomenon. It's clear to me that that's the case. But also, since she's got this sort of 200,000-year view of things, this is the necessary correction to centuries of, male dominance out of insecurity. After we go through this correction, can she speak to or address the notion when we're really going to reach true equality, true parity, true sharing?
How about true equality, Hannah?
That would be great. I mean, if I love this caller, because if that were the outcome of this, I think that would be the perfect world we want to get to, where, you have women breaking through those last barriers at the end. You have fairly equal men and women at the top of society and as decision makers in society. And so that would likely lead to more decisions that would make the workplace probably a little easier for all of us, not just women. So, I mean, that's a paradise that I would live in for sure.
You also take a look at what happened, and again, you referred to this earlier in our show, in Alexander City, Alabama, a town of 15,000, where the Russell Corporation, that's the maker of athletic wear, at one time employed almost half of the town's population. Yet, in the last 8 years, nearly all of them have lost their jobs. And here you say many women have taken over as primary breadwinners. You tell the story of Leandra Denny, whose husband was fired from Russell, the company there. What happened to her and her husband?
Well, they're the really falling apart story. I mean, he really did fall apart quite dramatically in that case. She says almost from the day he got the call from the corporation, it's quite a sad story where he became a drug addict and sort of fell off the map, and she was raising the kids alone. I mean, that wasn't necessarily typical. What I would say was typical more was that couples had to navigate new relationships because it's a southern town and Christian and very much believes in the man as the head of the household. And once some women were the main breadwinners in the town, you saw people delicately figuring that out. So what does it mean? Can the man still be the head of the household even if he's not bringing home the bigger paycheck? Is that still possible? So those were some of the questions the couples were asking themselves. And then I also explored how that seeped into the younger generation and the ideas that they picked up about what men and women do in a relationship and to keep together a family.
Well, I think Leandra probably gave you one of the best quotes for your book, because she ended up cleaning houses to keep cash coming in. And she said this: "I'm the kind of person, if I have to clean a toilet, I just put the Mr. Bubble in and make it work." But women, I just love
Can
that
I just
line.
Say that's like, it's a great line. And that's, she's actually, in her own words, parroting what is an official economic theory called the last one holding the bag theory, which an economist at the MIT Institute of Technology told told me, which was that women work, like I said, because they have to, because they're there with the children. And so they kind of have to make it work, you know, by necessity. And so that there was Leandra Denny kind of putting words to that philosophy.
You know, but in a sense, the women have, and you point this out, have always sort of done this, always done what's needed to make things work. And so you wonder why it's taken until now, you know, in 2012 for women to rise past men, if women, you know, have always been doing this.
I think it's the economic realities, frankly. I think it's just the recessions that we've had, you know, basically through the 90s and the 2000s, one thing after another. And it hit so hard a lot of the industries that were dominated by men. And so women maybe were primed at that moment to kind of hustle and take advantage of what was opening up, either because they had to or they wanted to. So, again, it's just a moment in history where, because it's true, the Southern women will say, well, we always run everything, you know, but you didn't really always run everything exactly. You know, it wasn't so true the way it is now.
Got an interesting email here from David on my Facebook page. He writes this: I cannot imagine a stronger curative for Congress than the election of more women in both houses. That doesn't mean I want a takeover, but something closer to 50-50 would be really interesting. And I've heard this before. He writes, I think women might just be able to get us out of gridlock. Am I wrong? I'll take a fresh breeze from wherever we can find it. What about that, Anna?
That's true. Actually, when women do get elected, that's the kind of language you hear around their election and their campaigns, a fresh breeze. There's an assumption that women make decisions more collaboratively, less recklessly, that they take the long term into account. Not that they're necessarily nicer, but they do make decisions slightly differently. And I actually feel quite hopeful that we're ready for that. Until now, I felt like we're still a little uncomfortable around female power and aggression of that particular kind that leads you to be a politician. But I think we're getting closer to the point where we can handle it.
Our phone number here, 816-235-2888. Our email address, updatedate@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. Again, we're visiting with Hannah Rosen, author of The End of Men and the Rise of Women. Brian McTavish will join us in just a few minutes with our weekend to-do list. You also have a chapter in this book titled The Top, which looks at women who have made it very far up the corporate ladder. You make note of what changes women in positions of power have brought into the work climate. Like what? What kinds of things do you talk about there?
Yes, this chapter has a different setup than the rest of the chapters, because when you look at the top, it's very different. And so I actually look at Silicon Valley, because Silicon Valley is very creative in how they structure their workplace to allow women some more flexibility. And so this isn't true of nearly, you know, the majority. This isn't true in the American workplace in general, but it's just interesting to take a peek and see how they creatively solve problems that allow women to be extremely ambitious and still be a presence in their children's lives, which I think is a goal for many women. And so they go home at 5:30, but they go back online again, you know, every night at 9. Or, you know, they make it every person gets to choose their priority at Google. And they get to say, you know, I have to go home on this day for this thing. And both men and women can choose. So one of the men in the book chooses it because he has a potluck supper with his roommates. Whereas for the woman, it's that she wants to go home to be at a soccer game from one of her kids. And so it kind of equalizes the playing field by letting women live a little more flexibly, but then not assuming that because they're doing that, they're not ambitious or don't want a top job.
You know, and several of these women that you profile in this book, you know, take on these positions of power, yet they continue to do the lion's share of the child rearing and work around the house. I mean, they women who work every single night, they never get to the gym, they never have a night out with their spouse. So you wonder how things are better for them when all they're doing is work, whether they're on the job or even at home.
Yeah, I mean, I think you just need that model to exist for whoever wants to take advantage of it. I don't think it's viable for all women, not all women. If you take Marissa Mayer, who was at Google, one of the women I interviewed and who recently was chosen as the CEO of Yahoo when she was visibly pregnant and also said that she didn't want to take a lot of maternity leave. Now, a lot of women, or she said almost none, and a lot of women look at that and say, oh my gosh, I would never want to do that. You know, who would want to take no maternity leave? But the idea that that model exists for some women who are by nature much more ambitious, that seems to me like a positive thing. It's definitely not for everyone, but it should be there for some people who can then break through and show us that women can do it if they want to.
Let's go to Ted from Kansas City, Missouri. Ted, you're on the program. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm really enjoying it, as always.
Good. Thanks.
Steve. I had two thoughts. One was, I keep on hearing a discussion about, you know, who makes more money and so on and so forth. And I know what stereotypes are about that and, you know, cultural learning and such. But to me, any man who would be not thrilled that his wife was making more money than him is not in a real partnership. I mean, it all goes in the same bank account, and you're supporting yourself and maybe your children. So I find it kind of sad, to be honest with you, that it's a competition instead of a partnership. And the other thing I was thinking is this, what's going on here is kind of a correction of history that some people call the destruction of the goddess, that female deities started to be destroyed thousands of years ago, and then the male dominance. And this is coming back to a natural balancing act, I think. It all makes perfect sense to me.
You know, Hannah, this idea that Ted just said, this is competition rather than partnership. Is that what you're describing here?
No, that's a good man. I mean, I have to say, it's not for some people experience it that way, for sure. I mean, lots of people find it uncomfortable. But in the 8,000 people I surveyed in the book who were in breadwinner marriages, most of them, 80% described their marriages as happy. There were definitely tensions under the surface because the old model has been around for so many years. It doesn't, you know, die without any noise. But they did say they were happy. And I was, you know, I was heartened by that, the idea that people could get used to it over time.
Ted, thank you. Appreciate the phone call, Ted. Nick writes us this. I recently read an article that talks about the end of men on Jezebel.com called The Rise of the Needy Man. And it also touched on a lot of good points about a shift in the gender roles and expectations of today's society. I can definitely see a shift in men becoming less confident and less dominant over women in society. But I also see that many have become more emotionally available. It was as if women had complained of men not being in touch with our emotions for years, and now we have overcompensated. That makes sense?
Yeah, I couldn't tell if he liked that trend or if he was critical of that trend. But there is a woman named Helen Fisher who, and I write about this at the end of the book, who does a lot of research off of dating sites. And she has pointed out a shift in men's attitudes on dating sites, that more men of certain ages express their desire to have children and their desire to be in long-term relationships. So this is a little bit of the male-female dating reversal we talked about earlier. And she's been tracking that trend over time and seeing it open up among younger men. So I don't know, you know, that seems okay to me, but maybe a lot of men would find it distasteful. I'm not sure.
Well, Hannah, I think you got Kansas City talking today. I sure appreciate you taking the time with us. What an interesting idea and a provocative new book. Again, the book is titled The End of Men and the Rise of Women. Hannah, all the best with it.
Thank you so much.